I'm on Sirius XM channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we continue our conversation about the road towards a cure for cancer and what part we all can play, particularly minority groups. My guest is Dr. Sonia Springfield. She is director of the National Cancer Institute's Center to Reduce Cancer Health Disparities. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. If you're having difficulty getting through, please keep trying. I promise we will take as many phone calls as we can, so please stay with us. Dr. Springfield, before the break, I was talking about clinical trials and the importance of having minority groups participate. What happens when they don't?
What happens with when they don't participate? We are 20 years behind when it comes to precision treatment for our cancers. As I spoke about earlier, that we're now discovering that some of the cancers faced by underrepresented populations have a different biology, have a different genetic makeup. And in order for us to be the recipients of new technologies and new treatments and new therapies, we have to participate on these trials that test the various drugs that are being developed both by the National Cancer Institute and other pharmaceutical companies to treat cancer. Some of the toxicology of these drugs may be different in our populations, in our genetic makeup. And so if we're not participating, one, to see if the drug works, two, to see if it's harmful, then we'll never benefit from those new discoveries. We have to be there. People have often used the term, oh, I don't want to participate because I'm a guinea pig. However, that's the wrong approach to take, especially in this day and age when therapeutics are coming down the drug discovery pipeline so rapidly. And if only the patients that are being treated with these drugs are white men, then we won't know if it's useful for African-American women,
mm-hmm.
simply stated.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Adrian, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Adrian. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Yes, go right ahead.
Yes, I'm glad you're having this topic because I actually lost a dog to cancer like less than 2 weeks ago. And I know a lot of people that have succumbed to cancer and didn't seek like aggressive treatment.
Mm-hmm.
I started researching like some of the natural therapies. And I wanted to know your thoughts or feelings on the acidic versus the alkaline state of your body, because I've started researching a lot about how the acidity in your body helps to progress the cancer even faster. So can you tell me anything about that? Or tell the audience anything about that?
Again, there are many factors that lead to aggressive spread of cancer. Mm-hmm. And it's not just one factor. And again, these factors can be different in different individuals. It can be different for animals as well. So I think the most important thing that you can take away from this discussion is to, one, seek treatment from your primary care physician and then have that physician refer you to a specialist, an oncologist. Again, the treatments are so varied and so unique to your type of cancer that I cannot say that there's one answer, because there isn't.
Mm-hmm. And thank you so much, Adrian. And I think you make an excellent point where the treatments are as varied as the cancers: brain cancer, lung cancer, breast cancer, cancer of the throat, cancer, oral cancer. And I would imagine that there are, you know, 5 to 10 different treatments for each kind and various
each
levels.
Stage.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
But to the point of this conversation, and I think you stated it exceptionally well, if African Americans, for example, do not participate in clinical trials, if they are not involved in the kind of information that becomes available that it may not be effective, or treatments down the road may not be effective for them, like you said, whether it's African Americans or Latinos or Native Americans or even ethnic whites.
I agree. Mm-hmm. There's an aggressive breast cancer that is seen in young African American women. It's triple negative. It presents very early. Usually women are between the age of 30 and 40. It's aggressive. There is no treatment, no known treatment for it. And until we get a treatment for triple negative breast cancer, and the only way possible to get that is to have these patients, once they're diagnosed, to participate on clinical trials, to donate their tissue, their tumor tissue and normal tissue, in order for researchers to discover markers of this disease. And when you can identify these markers very early in a patient, they can develop treatments to eradicate the spread and reduce the cancer.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Victoria, I'm sorry. We're going to get to Duane in just a bit. Victoria calling from Anne Arundel County. Victoria, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you, and good evening to all. I'm just trying to, understand more and have clarity. I am a breast cancer survivor. I went through the treatment, everything. I did take the BRAC test and was told that it was not genetic. But I'm trying to understand more because on both sides of the family, I have family members that either had prostate cancer, thyroid, lung cancer. So I'm just wondering if it's more predisposed versus the lack of healthy eating and exercise in the Black community, or is it just, maybe just an add-on or something of that nature?
Again, it's hard to predict what the causes are for you. Obviously, there is a genetic predisposition when you have multiple family members presenting with breast cancer and prostate cancer. It's important always for us to know our family history. That's the first step in awareness and knowledge about disease. You want to know if Aunt Sadie had breast cancer. You want to know if Grandma had colorectal cancer. My grandmother passed away from colon cancer. And so as a result of me knowing that, I started having my colorectal screening at age 40, as opposed to age 50, which is the recommended age for colorectal screening. So you have to know your family history, and you have to take care of your health the same way that you would take care of your car or your home. And often we in our communities, and this is inclusive of all Americans, we take care of ourselves last. But unfortunately, that does us a disservice if we wait too late.
Victoria, thank you for your phone call. Duane, calling from Waldorf, what's on your mind?
Yes, I just want to thank you for this show. This show has been a sign, along with many others, that has caused me to take action. I'm 49 years old. I'm active. I eat healthy. And as far as alkaline, I drink alkaline. And I just found out that I have colon cancer. I'm actually having surgery this Thursday to have it removed. I've been very mindful of, you know, my history. My sister did pass away from thyroid cancer, but the doctors are all wondering, you know, surprised that I caught it. And because I'm so healthy, because as a matter of fact, I've had my physicals on time. I've done everything that I'm supposed to do, but I agree with the doctor, is what she says. You know, there's never no pure reason why someone would catch it, because I'm a poor sign of, hey, I've done everything right, and here it is, I have colon cancer.
Well, Duane, thank you so much for sharing that. And certainly, good luck on Thursday. I'm quite sure, because you're paying attention, that you're going to come out just fine.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Dwayne. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Before we go back to the phone lines, you were talking about participating in trials. A couple of questions here. Black folks know their history. And, you know, what do you say to people who say, I'm not going to do it because I remember, you know, the Tuskegee experiment or hearing about that? It, you know, they, you said guinea pig, but, you know, that may be even looking at it likely. They, people don't want to be, they don't want folks fooling around with them. How do you,
right.
how do you?
Yeah, so the distrust of the healthcare system is always been a barrier for minorities, and in part due to the Tuskegee experience. But, you know, I look at it from two points of view. And the first point of view and the primary point of view for me is that Tuskegee worked in a sense that these men trusted this nurse who was an African-American woman. Now, she did her job in recruiting those men to that study. And that's what she was supposed to do. The men joined the study because they trusted her. Now, clearly the system is not always perfect. However, I use this example as a reason why we at the center spend so much time, effort, and energy devoted to training a generation of diverse cancer researchers because of that very trust issue. It's important that we see ourselves when we go into the physician's office, when we see ourselves when we go to the clinic and deal with a navigator who is trying to tell you about a clinical trial. We'll trust those individuals more so than not. And part of my passion for having a diverse workforce is to address that issue of distrust of the system.
And culture.
And culture. Mm-hmm. So we have created a program, which is called the Continuing Umbrella of Research Experience, for individuals from underrepresented populations. And we want them to become competitive cancer researchers in the end, because these researchers from our communities can address our problems because they're part of our community. They can bring a broader lens. They bring more innovation. They bring creativity. They bring a culture that's not typically seen or represented in the healthcare system. So we have to change the landscape in order for our patients to be comfortable talking to someone who came from their own backyard.
So how can someone who is interested in participating in the research, in trials, how do they get there from here?
How does a student get there from here?
Anyone who, if you know, for example, we just spoke to a man who's going to be having surgery on Thursday, and you spoke about, you know, if someone, you know, is diagnosed, how can their tissue be used? You know, even if, you know, they are expected, you know, to recover, but. And so how do you ask your doctor?
Absolutely.
I mean, and what kind of language
knowledge is critical.
What kind of language do you use with, you know, your doctor, your oncologist?
You ask him, are there any clinical trials being offered to address the cancer that you've been diagnosed with, number one. And the National Cancer Institute has thousands of clinical trials. NIH has thousands of clinical trials that are open and are desperately in search of individuals from underserved populations. So you ask your physician, you ask your oncologist up front.
And is there a phone number also to,
yes,
to where you are so that people can find out more information?
Well, first of all, for people who want information, general information about cancer, call 1-800-4-CANCER.
The number 4?
Yes.
Cancer. Mm-hmm.
And if you want to learn more about our programs, go to crchd.cancer.gov.
And, of course, that information will be posted on the website on whur.com after the program. Stay with us. Ali in Forestville, Tiffany in D.C., Eugene in Maryland will be talking to you next. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our discussion about finding a cure for cancer, what part we all can play. I'm going to go back to the phone lines. Ali calling from Forestville. Thanks for calling, Ali. What's on your mind?
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
My premise is you are not sick. You are thirsty. The number one cause of death in this country is not cancer, nor is it heart disease, but it's simply dehydration. Dehydration causes all disease because it sets up an acidic environment in your body. And when you have an acidic environment, based on what the brother was speaking to you earlier about, then disease finds a place to proliferate. So what we have is a water. When you change your water, you can change your life.
Yeah, Ali, let me stop you there, because one of the things, if you heard the brother who spoke earlier and then you heard this brother speak about really irresponsible statements as it relates to medical care. And certainly, you know, being, you know, an institution that is owned by not only an institution of higher learning, but also affiliated with a great hospital. I would caution anyone to say that there is just one cure. And I'm not a physician, but I would caution anyone to say that there is one sole cause of cancer. Dr. Springfield.
And again, I echo that point completely. If it were that simple, then I don't think anyone would be diagnosed with cancer. It's a very complex disease. Cancer is not one big cancer. It's many, many, many types of cancers. They arise in different ways. They present themselves in different ways. They spread in different ways. And it changes from one person to the next. It's just that complex. A simple solution, we all wish we had a magic bullet for cancer. I certainly do, and because my job would be over. And those individuals who are working on cancer, their jobs would be done. And we all want a cure for cancer. And we'd love for it to be something as simple as that. But unfortunately, it's not.
Thank you, Ali, for your input. How does a clinical trial work? Take me through the process. As you said, there are hundreds of clinical trials, and I'm sure that each one is different. But do they all have a certain pattern, a format, a process?
Yeah, I mean, typically there are different phases of a trial. The first phase has to do with is the drug toxic? And typically, those studies are not done in humans. The second phase is, recruiting patients with that particular cancer that they want to study. So a drug has to be developed, whether it be, again, by NCI or pharmaceutical or other drug companies. And they want to test that drug. They want to test the effectiveness of that drug, of that treatment, whether it be a single drug, and now most of the trials are utilizing combination treatments that seem to work best in some cancers. So one, they recruit patients for a particular cancer to test a drug that has been developed to see the effectiveness of that drug on either stopping the cancer, having the cancer relapse, having the cancer just disappear. I mean, there are various variations of clinical trials. And it's so basically, again, it's really testing a drug or an intervention. It doesn't always have to be a drug. It could be an intervention.
Meaning?
Let's say trials or interventions that will look at the benefit of eating 5 apples a day versus no apples to see if a diet influences the progression of cancer. So it's not always just a drug treatment. They're behavioral interventions. So trials can be of many, many forms and many fashions to test an intervention to see the effectiveness of that intervention.
So what happens in the example that you used, if you're an apple a day, then 2 apples a day, and does a doctor call you? Do you have a sheet that you fill out? Do you report once a week?
Yes, all of the above. And even now, they're using apps on your phones to test behavioral interventions. For example, iPhones will ask you, did you eat your 5 apples today? And when did you eat them? What time did you eat them? How much did you eat? I mean, and again, I'm being very simplistic
right,
in my
exactly.
definition here, but yes, there are many ways to test the protocol and to have the clinical trialist report the outcomes. You have to report the outcomes in order for them to be counted to determine what the impact of that treatment may be.
You mentioned students earlier. What specifically were you referring to?
I'm talking about our wonderful premier diversity training program, which is now celebrating 21 years. As a matter of fact, in 2 weeks, we're going to be celebrating 21 years with a cure. This is a program that was designed to address the leaky pipeline back in the early 70s when it came to diversity training programs, because there were a lot of targeted minority programs for research. And basically what they did was just to expose us to cancer research or to biomedical research. But the end game is to have a competitive cancer researcher or a competitive biomedical researcher in the end. What you have to have is continual funding opportunities to support those students from the time that reach us with support till their first academic appointment. So what we created was a continuum of funding opportunities, not just one experience, because that's not enough to capture anyone into a lifetime pursuit of cancer research, but a continuum from high school all the way to your first academic appointment. In addition to those mechanisms, we have what we call a holistic approach to career development and training. The things that we weren't taught in our PhD programs or in our MD programs as it relates to clinical research or biomedical research, for example, how to write a grant. The NCI and NIH supports research through funding grant mechanisms at academic institutions and or to individuals. And so that's what we do. We support academic institutions, including minority-serving institutions, HBCUs, tribal colleges, Hispanic-serving institutions, and we support individuals from high school all the way to their first academic appointment. That establishes them for a lifetime commitment in a competitive research environment. And we need to have those students to bring their perspective to the table, to bring their issues to the table, to do research on the cancers that's killing our populations. It's not that mainstream research doesn't address our cancers, because they do. Research on all cancers really help all people. But as I said earlier, there's some cancers that we're now seeing that are unique to a group or a population that have to be addressed.
You have been addressing this for quite some time, and considering your educational background, you are well suited for the work that you do. I only have about a minute left, but what is the thing that you would say you've learned from the kind of research that you've seen and the kind of work that you are doing, at the center?
I think what I've learned is that cancer is, in fact, an evolutionary disease. It's a very smart disease. But we're smarter, And I believe that one day we're going to cure cancer. And I believe that one day the cure may come from a student or a faculty member or a researcher who's from an underrepresented group. So my passion, you know, I had my own research laboratory at one time, and I said, well, it's wonderful to train students on a local level, but to have a national program that is now changing the landscape. We have some researchers that we are going to be honoring in 2 weeks that are innovators, that are pace setters, that are champions, that are, again, changing the diversity landscape of research, of biomedical research. And that's something that has fueled my passion for my life. And I am blessed and honored to have worked at the National Cancer Institute and at the Center to Reduce Cancer Health Disparities for all this time. And I could not have done it alone. I have a strong staff that has been there to support me and to help refine these programs. We have programs at minority-serving institutions that partner with our NCI-designated cancer centers in research, training, education, and outreach. We have a national outreach network program that's really working on screening efforts, making our communities more aware of the need to be screened, whether it be a mammogram or a colorectal colonoscopy or prostate cancer screening. All these things are critical. Early detection is the key and the solution.
Well, I want to start to end this by thanking Dr. Sonja Springfield with the National Cancer Institute Center to Reduce Cancer Health Disparities. And the information that we mentioned earlier will be posted on WHUR.com on the Daily Drum page a little after 8:30. So again, Dr. Springfield, thank you so much. I appreciate your work.
Thank you for inviting me.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141 for this Monday, June 12th. You can follow me on Twitter at HFisher, WHUR, or Daily Drum, WHUR. Now, stay tuned for The Connection with Lorna Newton. Good night.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 140.